on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another School for Startups Radio. We have an amazing show for you today, and I appreciate you being with us. What do you do when you want to give 1,000 people or 10,000 people some sort of economic assistance? You just can't give them all cash or a check. It's not as easy as that. It's one of those problems that I had never thought of, never seen. But thank goodness, Loren Pereira, our first guest, saw the problem, solved the problem with a company called Give Card. It is an amazing exploration of problems and what us entrepreneurs do. It's a great interview. I'm excited to share it with you. Ben, I don't know if you know or not, we have a little game show that we do here from time to time called The Quick 10. Always the same 10 questions, and the guests get to answer. It's a lot of fun. We learn a little bit of how they think about creativity, risk, all of these things. Today, we have Rhea Wessel to play The Quick 10 with us. Love some of her answers. It is a great feature. And then in our continuing series of rebuilding our dead server, a greatest hit feature, Dr. Sarah Falaw is with us. She is continuing the work of The Millionaire Next Door. Do you remember that book from 20 years ago? Her father wrote it, and she is now a PhD doing the same thing, spreading the message that millionaires drive Ford F-150 pickup trucks, not Mercedes or Rolls Royces. Millionaires shop at Sears. Oh, Sears doesn't exist. Does Sears exist? Anyway, not at the Ritz-Carlton. You don't shop at the Ritz-Carlton, do you? You know what I mean, though. Millionaires think about money differently. She's going to tell us. We got a great show. We're going to get started in just like 5 seconds. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Imagine getting into Harvard and dropping out because you have a business idea that is just too good. You have to go and do it. That is what our next guest did. Please welcome Loren Pereira to the show. He is the CEO of Gift Card, and he was at Harvard studying, quit after a year because he had a more important thing to do in his life. He is originally from Malawi and is now building an incredible business called givecard.com. I will let him explain it. Loren, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, Jim. Doing well. Thanks for that intro. No, I'm doing great.
You know who the other person who dropped out of Harvard was?
I think I'm going to get pointed at Mark Zuckerberg here, which is not a fair comparison.
I was going with Billy Gates.
Oh, yep. Bill's one of them, too.
So you're in good company.
Yeah, I'm an intimidating company for sure. But they were doing a lot better when they made their decisions. I think my decision was
That. Tell us the story.
Absolutely. So, you know, Harvard wasn't actually the only place I studied. I actually did my undergrad at Boston College. Harvard is where I did my master's, and that's where I chose to drop out. The quick gist of Give Card is I was on the street in downtown Boston coming back from dinner with my roommates. Came across a person, a former veteran facing homelessness, really good guy. We were chatting. And at the end of the conversation, he said, "Hey, do you have like 10 bucks? I need a new winter jacket and I'm trying to save up for it." It's a really cold night in Boston. So I opened my wallet. I looked through it. I didn't have cash on me. I looked to my roommates. Neither of them did either. And we apologized. He said, "So sorry, we don't have cash on us." And he said, "Don't worry, this happens all the time." And I'm sure we'll talk more about what GiveCard is today, but the general high level of what GiveCard is how do we get money to people in a society moving cashlessly? Checks are not going to cut it. Store-bought gift cards like a Target gift card are not going to cut it. How can we take modern financial technology, but put it in the sense of giving people money? And that's really the ethos of GiveCard and what we've become today. And, you know, I'm sure we'll walk through the story of what eventually drove me to say, all right, I'm dropping out of grad school and I'm doing this full time and we'll figure it out from there.
Well, let's go and describe GiveCard better first and then come back to the dropping out. So exactly how does the program work?
We work with organizations that already have money, and we typically work with organizations that have sizable amounts of money and want to give it to quite a lot of people. So we're talking about nonprofits, we're talking about governments, we're talking about hospitals. So for governments, we power veteran assistance in California. We power emergency relief programs in North Carolina, Texas, Los Angeles. In nonprofits, we do stuff like food stipends. How do you give people like grocery assistance for the week? How do you help people pay their deposits to move into a new apartment? With hospitals, we'll help with hospitals in medication assistance, transportation assistance, getting someone a stipend to get to the hospital, because otherwise they wouldn't come in because they can't afford the transportation. And obviously sending an ambulance is too expensive, so why not send an Uber, right? And so we work in all of these different places where money is moving from a business entity to a person. And, you know, now we do enterprise too, because we built such good technology for impact-oriented organizations to give money to people that airlines started calling us up and saying, hey, you know, when we have a canceled flight, we have to offer people a cash alternative for their flight. And giving someone paper cash in an airport is a mess. You wouldn't believe this, Jim, but airlines like Delta, I won't say which airline, but airlines like Delta have a safe at airports filled with cash to give people cash reimbursement because they can demand it due to new federal regulation. And so these airlines will work with us to give cash alternatives to people over prepaid reloadable cards, which is primarily what we do. Yes, it's all about how do we give money to people.
All right. So I have a charity, a foundation, and I want to give away $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I hire you. What happens next?
So we're that last mile. We're not a nonprofit consultant or anything like that. So you will know who you want to give the money to. So let's talk about what happened before us, actually, because what we do plays best when you understand that context. Before we came around, you have to give away $1 million. Let's say you're giving $1,000 to 1,000 people, to keep it simple. You would probably go up to these 1,000 people and say, how do you want to be paid? Some people say, well, here's my bank account, routing and account number. We'll give that to them. Some people say, I don't have a bank account. Like, can you give me cash? Can you give me a check or whatever? And so typically what orgs would do is for the bank account individuals, they'd collect their account and routing number manually, either like literally pen and paper or onto like an Excel spreadsheet. And for the people that want cash, they'll write them a paper check. This is all happening manually. So each of these bank transfers, someone's logging into Wells Fargo, and, you know, let's say half the people wanted a bank transfer 500 times, typing in an account and routing number that they have on a piece of paper and an Excel spreadsheet. They've never verified that this is correct. They have no idea if there's a typo. They'll type this in each time and just keep hitting send over and over again. For the cash components, they're manually writing paper checks and giving this to someone. That individual probably doesn't have a bank account, otherwise they would have given their bank account information. And so then they have to go to a third-party check cashing service and lose 10% of that money to a check casher who's just like raking it in on fees. And so what we do is we come in and we simplify all of these. We have tools that do that bank account collection. And when you give your account and routing number, we'll verify, is this a real account? Does this actually belong to you, or did you give a typo and now the money would have gone to someone else or into the void and now we're able to catch that? If you're saying, I want a cash alternative, we can issue a card to your Apple wallet. We can issue a physical card to you. When that card is stolen, or if that card is stolen, we can freeze it and issue a new one so the funds don't go missing. We can have tracking on that so that the organization that gave out the money, let's say you gave out this $1,000 to 1,000 people, so $1 million, you can say, oh, off the $1 million we gave out, 60% was spent on groceries, 20% was spent on transportation, 10% on education or childcare or whatever it might need to be. And so we're able to, it's essentially bringing modern technology to solve a problem that has existed for a long time, which is how do you get money to people? And so we build a ton of different tool sets and the actual financial infrastructure beneath those tools to do it. So we're our own card issuer, we're our own bank transfer organization as well.
All right. Fascinating. Unbelievable. And it's about 6 years old at this point.
Yeah, coming up on 7, exactly.
And how much have you facilitated?
We've probably given close to $1 billion at this point.
Wow, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And how do you make money?
So we make nothing from the recipients. That's a policy. That's something I stand strongly behind. The second we even start to make pennies on recipients, someone's going to want us to make dollars on recipients, and it's never going to end. And so I'm firm on not making money from the end recipients here. We're fee-free there. We make money from the orgs that we work with, so the nonprofits, the governments, wherever they might be. We have very upfront, transparent monthly pricing that's in the range of $3,000 to $5,000 at the low end to $10,000 to $15,000 at the high end a month that orgs will pay us for these services. And, you know, if you think about it, like, we're talking at the high end orgs that are giving out money to hundreds of thousands of people every single month. They would have to have teams of dozens of people manually writing these checks that they often outsourced to other countries to use check writing softwares to do. But we've kind of come in, brought things in nation and simplified significantly. And so that's primarily where fees come from. But also we are the payment infrastructure. So all the money that sits in the financial accounts, we're the ones that run these financial accounts. We work with partner banks so we can make yield on this, on the money that's sitting. We're the card issuer. So every time a card is swiped, when Visa, who's our partner, pays the issuer for issuing the card, we're the card issuer. So we're going to make some money there too. So we have this two-sided thing where, you know, we can support hundreds of thousands, millions of recipients without taking a cent from them because we're the infrastructure, so we make money there, and we're the software providers, so we make money there.
All right, so say Delta or some other airline wants to hire you. They come in at $20,000 a month, mm-hmm. and from then on, are they going to have a stack of gift cards in that safe instead of cash?
They might. You know, they might. With airlines, they find virtual pretty easy. So with an airline, it could be as simple as saying, hey, you know, we have on hand all of these cards, but the cards aren't going to be preloaded. They'll be empty, so we can remove the security liability. And so the Delta agent, as someone's doing their claim, can go into our software. And again, it's not Delta. I'm just not allowed to say who it is.
Right.
But the Delta agent can go into our software and say, this specific physical card, load it with $2,000 because that's exactly what the person paid for their ticket. This person paid $1,400, so load it with that because that's exactly what they paid. Or instead of giving them a physical card, they can just tap their phone on a little contactless receiver that they have there, and their phone will pop up with a card, with one of our cards into their Apple wallet that they can just use an Apple Pay or Google Pay or whatever. So we usually let the end recipient decide, do you want Apple Pay? Do you want Google Pay? Do you want a physical card? Or do you want this to your bank? And that's an option too. Delta could say, all right, well, if you don't want a card, we're going to text you a link that you can enroll, and then you'll get a bank transfer to your bank account instead. Being very honest with you, I have a bank account. I use Bank of America. It's fine. I don't get charged fees. Obviously, I don't overdraft. So, overdraft fees don't affect me right now. But with that Bank of America account, I would rather get money there than get someone handing me a physical card. And I know that's almost sounds detrimental to our business model, but I want to be real here. I would prefer to get money to my bank account. And so we built bank transfer rails too and offer that. But there's 26 million Americans without a proper bank account at all. And even more with really predatory, or we call them underbanked, with bank accounts that don't really serve as what a bank account should serve as. And so for those Americans, many of them will prefer to just get a card that charges them no fees, works everywhere, and is really intuitive over using either not a bank and a check cashing service or a bank that's going to charge them fees in every single load.
Are there restrictions on what they can use the cards for?
It's up to the org. So, I mean, at a base level, we have our money laundering protection restrictions. So this won't work at casinos. This won't work in escort services. For the actual organizations, they can decide from there what level of restrictability to have. Nonprofits will typically have, you know, maybe no alcohol, so no liquor stores. They might have no ATMs, right? So keep everything within system. Typically for-profit companies like a Delta that's just giving someone money, they really don't care how someone spends the money, so they might have these unrestricted. But we have varying degrees. We're doing a program with the city of LA right now, doing for money to parents trying to support their children. It's a grocery program. So the cards only work at grocery stores within LA. So you can't go traveling outside of LA and spending this wherever you want. It's meant for, this is school time grocery assistance program for parents within LA. It can't be spent outside of that. And so we have various levels of restrictability and what people need, and we're willing to support or able to support all of them.
All right. Very cool. I love the program in LA. That's fantastic. All right. As you said, let's go back and tell some of the other stories. Talk about dropping out of Harvard and the decision process you went through there, and then start telling us how you built the business. What'd you do 6 months before you started? What'd you do day one? How'd you get your first customer? Go.
Yeah. So when I originally had this idea, I thought that this should be a nonprofit because it's all about just giving people money. I thought, well, people give people money all the time. Nonprofit is the way to go. I can raise some donations and this is how I'll build the company. And for many years, Jim, I mean like 2 to 3 years, even a little more, I ran this company as a nonprofit. And so we had no revenue model, but it was all about donors will fund the infrastructure. And then we'll work for free with other nonprofits to give money out. The quick, fast story is that donors don't want to fund infrastructure. No one wants to pay you so you can pay some big bank behind the scenes and you, so you can pay MasterCard or Visa or whoever it is. No one really wants their donation to go towards that, or at least not very many people. And so that wasn't a model that was viable. What was interesting and where we realized that there could be a business in all of this is that these nonprofits that we're offering this infrastructure to, even though at the time we were a nonprofit, they were saying, we'll pay you for this. Like, Lorraine, like, thank you, like, this is free, but we'll pay you, you know? And it wasn't a lot of money. They're saying, pay you $150 a month, and we'll pay you for every card too. For every card that we use, we'll pay you a dollar every month, like a buck a month. So we weren't making that much. But there was this interesting signal of, wait, these nonprofit executives, I'm offering them something free. And they're saying, no, I'll pay you for this. This is solving huge issues for me. And so that was really, really fascinating to me. Now, what had happened is, again, I'm from Malawi, and so I'm not a U.S. citizen. I have to play very carefully with employment law here. You can run a nonprofit as a non-citizen on not a work visa, and that's totally fine. You can't go and run a fintech company. You can't go and run a tech company. And so when we realized this, that this could actually be a for-profit company, unfortunately, like, I didn't have a work visa. Very careful. And so I decided, hey, like, I can't. Like, I need to wait until I get a work visa and do this the right way. And at the time, I'd already committed to grad school and I'd already committed to Harvard. I was going to study a program that, you know, is actually very relevant. Is about how do you, it's called design impact engineering. It's taking complex human problems and solving them with engineering solutions. Very much what GiveGrad does. So I'd already committed to the program. I was already on the program's visa. I could only really be a student. What is interesting is when I called up people that I'd known from college that were mentors, alumni of Boston College, and I said, hey, like, look, I'm going to go to grad school. They said, sure, but when you're ready to leave, I'll give you $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 to back whatever you're doing. I'll back it right now. And that was really interesting to me. So I'm going, well,
this person?
They're alumni. Well, this one, you know, I'll call him out. He's an awesome dude. Justin Robinson, you know, he sold his company to Uber for over $1 billion. So he's good for it. I knew he was, but he wasn't the only one. He was the first one. He called me and he said, I'll give you $100,000 for the company that you build if you're ready to drop out when you're ready, when you're able. And then I started calling up other people. Justin was really the one that built the confidence and said, hey, Justin's willing to give me $100,000 if I drop out and focus on this. Would you put up money? And, you know, it went from, there were very few angels that could write those kind of checks, but it very much became smaller venture funds and seed funds and pre-seed funds. We put together a couple, we've never publicly disclosed how much money we've raised. I probably won't do that right now, but we raised quite a few million dollars.
I have it right here in my notes. Your publicist sent me the number.
Well, he shouldn't. So good to know.
Right here, it says $9 trillion.
There we go. Right. Oh, no. It looks like it's leaked. Well, anyway, Jim, I think no better place to announce the $9 trillion raise that we did now. But we've never publicly disclosed that. So thank you for keeping your discretion here. That shouldn't have reached your fact sheet. But we raised quite a few million dollars in, you know, the matter of a couple phone calls. On this commitment of if I do, and if I'm able to leave school, this is what I'll do. So I had that conviction. And then the other side of things, I had companies, nonprofits tell me, I'll pay you money for this business if you build it. So I said, hey, this could be a really interesting for-profit company. And we're not really doing anything wrong here. Like, the nonprofits are happy to pay. I'm not forcing them to pay. We're not charging end recipients anything. And the VCs are happy to subsidize this until we get to the scales where we have enough nonprofits. Why wouldn't I build this business? So I go to grad school and I'm working as a student. I really can't build the company. And I applied for this visa called the O-1 visa, which is essentially the U.S. government saying, and this isn't me trying to brag, this is just what it's called. Like, you have extraordinary ability. You should be able to do whatever you want here, obviously within a 3-year time period. But if you want to build a company in those 3 years. If you want to be a researcher, you have 3 years to do this. And so after a year of grad school, I was awarded that. This is why I don't like the Zuckerberg or the Gates comparisons with dropping out. I didn't have a successful company with a ton of revenue. I didn't have, you know, 50,000 people signing up every day for a service, or I didn't have enterprises calling me for this. But I did have investors with money to back. I had people, like friends from college that knew I could call and would commit to this. And I had customers that would sign up and pay small amounts of money, but money for a service. So I had the core pieces saying this should be a business, or this can be a business. And I guess the answer is, should it be? And so I dropped out to figure that out. If I'm being really honest, education, higher education also just was not for me. And so that played a factor into it. There's a question on whether I would have finished my degree even if there wasn't a company, but it made it easy that there could have been a company. And so that the second I got a visa and I was approved to go work, I did that.
How do you have such an amazing Rolodex? Where did you get this Rolodex?
Throughout college, I'd been trying to start small startups, right? And I built, you know, as a freshman, I had a pet fish that I took care of with my whole floor. There were 20 people. And the fish died because on a single day, and this is not a joke, more than half of us fed the fish on a single morning. And we'd been doing this forever. And this fish had some serious health. And we just had no idea. We weren't communicating. So I built like this.
It ate itself to death.
Yeah, it literally ate itself to death. And now, you know, I built this random app that was about coordinating pet care with families or groups of carers. And I put this out as a freshman as part of a class I was doing. You know, it got 50 or 60,000 active users. It did pretty well. Ultimately, after working on this for a couple months, I asked myself, do I actually even want to be building like a pet care management app? Do I care about a pet care management app? Like, it's funny because at that time I asked myself a question that I asked myself years later is, would I drop out of school? Which is weird that it was on my mind, but would I drop out of school for a pet care manager? No, like not really. Like, am I actually like, yes, I love pets. I have a dog. I adore my dog. But is this something that I want to spend my career building? Probably not. But in the time of building this, alumni were reaching out and saying, hey, who's this freshman that's building this random app that actually has a decent user base? And so built friendships with them, built friendships with professors that connected me with people like that. Boston College has a really tight-knit community. It's not known for entrepreneurship. It has wonderful entrepreneurs that have come out of it. People like Bill Clarico from WePay, people like Justin Robinson, who sold to Uber for $1 billion. And they're all fairly recent. They're people that have done this in the last 10 or 15 years. And so they're really trying to give back to the community. And so I just had a great Rolodex of people that are saying, hey, when you are building something that you care about, we're here. Call us, text us, ask us for. And a lot of them are investors in GiveCred today. Still, I'm actually meeting with some of them right after our call, people that invested us at the very beginning stages before we had anything. So it is an awesome community.
Oh, very cool. Well done. All right. So who did you get, like, is your first big customer?
I would say that, you know, big. So we keep getting bigger and bigger. I think a really name brand customer outside of impact. Well, we signed the state of Massachusetts. That's a big customer.
Yeah.
That's a big customer. We signed the city of Somerville, Mass. We signed the city of El Monte, California. We have contact with LA, like Los Angeles. But the state of Massachusetts was a very big one for me because they called me. We didn't call them. We have customers in Massachusetts that are nonprofits. And these nonprofits do various forms of how do you help youth transitioning out of the foster system? Because you finish the foster system, and if you're not, and then you're essentially put out on your own. And a lot of these kids don't go to college. And so they end up in this very weird transition period where it's really hard to find employment and you don't have a familial system to fall back on in a lot of the cases. This nonprofit's called Break Time. You know, I would look into them if you're a listener. They've done amazing things. They bought a full-on building in downtown Boston. Like, I mean, a real commercial building. That's how well they're doing in terms of the lives they're changing and how much donations they're able to bring in and continually do. And they're an amazing company. They work with the state on helping youth transition from the foster system into employment, specifically into employment. And so the state called them up and said, hey, Break Time, like, we're really, really struggling with how do you get money directly to people, especially people without bank accounts? People just come out of the foster system, whatever. Because, oh, use GiveCard. You know, we've used them for years. They're fairly cheap. I mean, at the time, Break Time didn't know that they were getting way cheaper price than everyone else. But it's low cost. Like, everyone loves it. The recipients enjoy it. It's really simple. Call up GiveCard. The state, the Secretary of Labor of Massachusetts called me. And it's funny because it was a cold call. I didn't get a warning that I was getting the call. And I picked it up. And I heard the introduction on the Secretary of Labor of Massachusetts, and I hung up. And then I get an email.
Why'd you hang up? You thought it was a prank?
Well, I thought it was a prank. Wouldn't you, Jim? Like, okay, actually, Jim, I bet you get some pretty important people calling you. But I thought it was a prank. I mean, of course it's a prank. It's definitely my buddies from college razzing me up. But anyway, then I got an email from the Breaktime CEO saying, hey, just got a note. The Secretary of Labor tried to call you. You called him back. It's real. And I said, oh, okay. So then I called him back. And then we had a conversation. Said, hey, look, we're just trying to understand it. They weren't trying to buy from us directly. They're just trying to understand, like, how should we think about this? What should we think about? And I was saying, like, this is what you should think about. Are people charging costs, whatever? Any sort of state contracting is, and it should be, a long process. Multiple people need to be able to bid. It needs to be an open and fair process. So we went through all of that. So it took a couple months to go through. They put in an RFP. We bid on the RFP. We did well. And so we were able to win the RFP. But that was a pretty great moment to say a state government got our advice on how do you get money to people that don't have great bank accounts. And then we were able to work with the state on doing that. And, you know, we've worked with, at this point, there's more than 100 governments that use gift card technology today all over the country. And we do things from, you know, like emergency relief, like we're doing in LA, Texas right now, North Carolina last month. And as well as like smaller things, like how do you fuel librarians' cards, you know, in Ohio? The library system provides cars to librarians. Those librarians previously would have to pay for their gas and then get reimbursed at the end of a month. If I'm a librarian, I'd rather just not have to be reimbursed and have the gas covered to begin with. So now one of our cards is sitting in every one of the state of Ohio's librarian cars, and it's set to only work up to a certain amount and only work at gas stations in Ohio. Sorted. And so we're able to do really, really interesting things at every level. And I think the state of Massachusetts deal was a realization that it's not just nonprofits that would use this, or smaller for-profit companies. It's them. You know, we have enterprise customers now in many different industries, but I think that was a really cool one.
Fantastic. Boy, this is an amazing story, and I can't wait to follow it and see how this goes. We're out of time. How do we find out more about you? Participate this, get our business signed up, contact you, all that, please.
If you're giving money to people and you're giving money directly to people, whether it's 20 people or 200,000 people a month, look up givecard.com, GIVECARD, give card. I kind of hate how similar it sounds to gift card. If I could go back 7 years, maybe I'd change that. It's too late now. We own a lot of gift card stuff. Look us up, reach out. Our team are fast. Even if you don't really know what you need, we help with talking through what should you be thinking about when it comes to giving people money, not just logistically, but on the compliance end, on the accounting end, on the regulation end. How do you close your books at the end of every year? This is a gift. Is this tax deductible for the person? We have teams that do all of that. So reach out. Happy to help. Jim, it was great being here. This is awesome.
Thank you so much. You were fantastic. And I'm so impressed with what you've done. And I'm sure that they will include you soon in the Harvard Dropout Memorial.
Memorial is right. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you so much for being with us, and we will be right back. Bye, bye, bye. We are back, and I have another brave contestant willing to play the Quick 10. Please welcome Ray Wessel to the show. She is author of a 5-star rated book called Write Like a Thought Leader, How to Find a constant stream of story ideas to position yourself as the go-to expert in your niche. Absolutely great interview with her on thought leadership. But now we're going to play the Quick 10. Ray, thanks for being with us and willing to play the Quick 10.
Thank you, Jim. Happy to be here.
You're in Germany, so I'm not sure what the laws are, but I'm required by American law to ask, are you currently sober?
Yes, I am currently sober.
Okay.
And I'm happening to be in Houston, Texas right now.
Oh, okay. So, Texas, those laws I do know. Do you want to accept the wager? Do you want to accept our standard wager?
Okay, I think I better say yes.
There you go. Number one, your favorite creativity hack.
My favorite creativity hack is free writing. That is writing to a clock. Just let the clock tick and write into a brain dump. That is free writing.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
It's not exactly bootstrapping, but I like virtual assistants who teach me. They teach me things as they do it.
Number three, name your top passions.
It's people, ideas, writing, connecting dots and building my craft.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
I would say it's a bit like writing an article. You've got to find your niche, you got to frame your idea, and then you got to flesh it out. The three steps to thought leadership writing are can be about three steps to starting a business.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Referrals and referrals.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
It's AI that shows its logic and helps me with research and is a good sparring partner.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice?
Just do it.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake?
Overinvesting in the wrong spots.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
I like Tim Ferriss. I resisted him at first with his 4-hour work week, but then I fell into his charm. I like the way he gives tips and shares advice and has a unique perspective.
Number 10, favorite superhero?
I think it's got to be Wonder Woman. She's who I grew up with. She still spins around in my mind today.
Excellent answers. While we calculate your score and find out the winner of the wager, how do we find out more about you and get a copy of your book, Thought Leaders?
Yeah, find me on LinkedIn, Rhea Wessel, R-H-E-A's name. InfoThoughtLeadership.com is the website. Book is on Amazon. New book coming out about how to build a thought leadership program in a small and mid-sized company. So look for that in 25 and reach out. Love to hear from you.
Fantastic. I would love to interview you about that book as well. So Ray, we will have you back for that in 6 months or so. Oh, I've just been giving your score. Oh, I'm so sorry for you. You got a 94. 94 is an excellent score. Oh. You have to have a 95 to win. And so you unfortunately lose the wager. We had a judge from France and a judge from Oklahoma. And apparently they dinged you. It was German bias, I think. Anti-German bias. Damn them. And anyway, you owe us a Tesla. We always play for a Tesla, Ray. So I'll look forward to receiving that soon. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Just send your address for shipping.
Excellent. I will do that. I just have to comment on Tim Ferriss. He is charming, but the idea that you can succeed in 4 hours a week, I hate that idea out there. The book should be called How to Get By on 4 hours a Week After You Spend 400 Hours a Week for a While. I just think he's misleading people.
He is. And please, I hope you're still recording. Please put this out there as well. That's why I resisted it for years, because I have been in business already so long. I'm like, this is nonsense. But he ends up giving all kinds of other good advice. And, and learning to outsource certain tasks in your business is a particular skill.
That's a great idea, but you still just don't spend 4 hours.
Absolutely don't. And I don't like it when people don't deliver on their headlines. And it's basically, it's clickbait.
Yes, exactly.
And that's why I wouldn't go there.
Clickbait titling.
And I don't like that. But he actually delivers, is just not what in the title.
Yeah.
I hope you can put this out there too. Just tag that onto our interview.
We will.
So,
Ray, thank you so much for being with us. Great stuff, and we'd love to have you back.
Love to be back as well, Jim. Have a good day.
Red Tesla.
Okay.
On climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now, because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
And welcome back to the show. I am so excited and honored to welcome my first guest today. The body of work that we're going to talk about is one of the most important, the most seminal bodies of work for entrepreneurship that is out there. We're talking about the whole millionaire next door philosophy that was proposed decades ago by Thomas Stanley and Charles Danko. Is it Charles, Sarah? Help me.
Bill Danko.
That's it. And so anyway, several books have come out. There's been a lot of talking about this. And there is a new book that has just come out called The Next Millionaire Next Door. It is based on the work of Dr. Stanley and written by his daughter, Dr. Sarah Stanley Falah. She is a psychologist, an industrial psychologist, researcher, and president of a company called Data Points, and she has been continuing the research of her father, studying the wealth of America, how people get rich, how people become millionaires, all of that. I am obsessed with this, and I think it's one of the most important things that I can share with you, is that millionaires don't spend a lot of money. Sarah, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm so glad to be here. I'm doing great.
Is that a fair thing to say? Is that the biggest shocker about millionaires, is they just don't spend as much money as we think?
Yeah, you know, I think their whole lifestyle, just going along with that idea, their whole lifestyle is a little different than what's portrayed in the media. Even though, like you said, The Millionaire Next Door, it came out over 20 years ago now, people still believe what they see. And we think of wealth is what people are driving and living in, you know, fancy houses and things like that. But in reality, they're spending in a way that's allowing them to become millionaires.
Right. I absolutely love it. And there was just some shocking data points that came out of the whole body of research. Some of my favorite, the number one car most likely to be driven by a millionaire, right? Of course, Mercedes, Maserati, BMW, Rolls Royce, right? What is your answer, though, Sarah?
Right, exactly. So just like in The Millionaire Next Door, where, you know, the cars you wouldn't think were, you know, important, now it's Toyotas and Fords and Hondas that are driven by millionaires.
See, that's just so counterintuitive. If I can't, you know, what's the whole point then in getting to be a millionaire, Sarah, if I don't get to drive the Mercedes?
Right. Well, I absolutely. I think the point is, you know, you can certainly drive those things, and that's, you know, everyone can make their own decisions about that. But it's that building wealth process. So if you're going out and you're buying a car in anticipation of becoming wealthy, that's what really can trip you up. And I think that that's what trips up a lot of people with relatively high incomes, is they think, hey, I'm out of school, for example. I'm starting out, let's say, in some technology firm, or maybe as an attorney or something like that. I've got six figures. What can I do with this? You know, it's I need to look at a certain part. And I think that continues to be something that folks struggle with.
Yes, because you have to look like a $300 an hour attorney to be a $300 an hour attorney, right?
That's right. I mean, that's right.
And that means that exactly. We meet at the club. You know, our initial meeting is at the club, and I wear a $2,000 suit, right? So I'm spending money as faster a lot of times than I can make it, right? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, and the trouble with that, of course, is when you decide you don't like that job anymore, 5 or 6 or 7 years down the road, and you decide you want to do something for yourself and perhaps start a new business or go into business with someone else or something like that, that income dries up really quickly. And now you're going to have to, you know, be faced with a different kind of lifestyle to support this new idea, new adventure that you're on related to your career.
You know, I always look at these athletes and movie stars, and someone like Johnny Depp, for example, who has made $700 million in his career and is $200 million in debt. And you just look at it and you go, you know, how?
Yeah, you know, part of his trouble, too, was not, you know, spending the time doing research around the folks that were helping him with his finances. I think that you see millionaires continuing to spend time, you know, getting the knowledge they need to make decisions, important decisions, like who's going to help me with my financial planning or any kind of other professional service, they really spend the time doing the research. And clearly, Mr. Depp didn't do that very well.
Well, you know, that was one of the incredible findings of the whole body of research that I remember that sticks out is what millionaires read. Millionaires read differently than non-millionaires, don't they? You know, I read, you know, you're worth $10 and let's go talk about your radiator magazine, Sarah. What do millionaires read?
That's right. Yeah. So those are definitely findings from, you know, related to looking at journals and practitioner articles related to their own business. So if you're thinking about, again, millionaires who have created their own wealth through self-employment, they spend time reading up on their business. They are engrossed in their industry. They know what trends are, and they're doing that instead of, you know, for lack of a better example, playing video games or Fortnite or something like that. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but, you know, that's what they're spending their time on.
And credit cards. What do we know about credit cards and the way millionaires use, don't use credit cards? What credit card are they most likely to carry?
Oh, good question. You know, we didn't follow that up in the new study, so that's definitely based on the 96 work.
But still one of my favorites. So yeah, if you don't remember, I do.
People love that one. Yeah. So again, I think I've shared this before, but, you know, in 1996, I was in college. It was the Olympics. You know, those kinds of things were going on in my life. So when the book came out, you know, I thought that this was interesting, but it wasn't yet on my radar. But no, they definitely, you can see that in the book.
All right. Let's talk about the new millionaire next door, the next millionaire next door. Congratulations. It is extremely well ranked over on that Amazon place with a whole bunch of reviews. Have we seen any significant differences? So we have like almost a whole new generation of millionaires now. Are we seeing the same patterns or not?
You know, we're seeing the same general behaviors and attitudes about living their life and their lifestyle. So being disciplined and persevering, hard work continues to be one of the, you know, success factors that millionaires cite as, you know, that allow them to be successful and become millionaires. But the things that are different are around education. So, for example, more millionaires today have advanced degrees, which makes sense, right, given kind of the state of education and things like that. We see a lot of differences in job titles, obviously a lot in technology and engineering. That's become more prevalent, if you will, in terms of the millionaire population. And they do tend to spend more on their home. So we've seen a slight increase an increase in what they're paying for their home. So that's changed. But again, I go back to the, kind of those core behaviors and patterns of lifestyle that they're living. Those haven't changed. And I believe they won't change over time.
And that core thing, I just want to reiterate the daylights out of it. Is it three words? Four words. Live below your means. Is it just that simple that no matter what you're making, you got to be putting 20% away?
Yeah, you know, that tends to be, you know, one of the things that's cited, particularly again for individuals that are maybe at the 1 million to 5 million mark. You know, when we're talking about decamillionaires and those that are ultra high net worth, that tends to be maybe a little less important because at that point, you know, they can go out and get that Mercedes that we talked about earlier. But really those success factors have to do with being disciplined, having integrity, getting along with others, all those things that are critical really to running your own business or being successful within a career. Those continue to be what millionaires cite as really critical versus things like, you know, having, you know, graduating at the top of your class or attending a private school or something like that.
Again, we are talking about millionaires and their very distinct mindset with Dr. Sarah Stanley Falau. She is the author of the new book, The Next Millionaire Next Door. Sarah, What about the internet boom? So we had this tulip-like event here since the publication of the first book in the last two decades. Has that, and the ability to become a billionaire in 16 days, has that changed any of the basic underlying of your research?
Yeah, you know, where we see that really impact individuals, particularly, again, we study individuals across the board. So whether we're talking about somebody making $25,000 a year or, you know, millionaires and decamillionaires, what we see being really critical now is the ability to focus, the ability to remove distractions from your life in order to fulfill and work towards goals that are important. So whether we're talking about financial goals within your household or talking about professional goals, again, whether you're creating a business or you're trying to excel in your career, what that sort of technology has led to is this ever-present distraction around us because we carry, you know, supercomputers in our pockets, right, or wear them on our wrists. So that's what we see is becoming more of an issue, I would say, in terms of the things that can trip you up.
And educate me about Mr. Money Mustache and the, I don't know how you pronounce it. Is it the FIRE movement? It's got a dash in the middle, FIRE. I would call it FIRE. Talk to me about Mr. Money Mustache, and I will give you one of, I'm repeating your own words back to you here, Sarah. One of your favorite quotes from him is, "Your current middle-class life is an exploding volcano of wastefulness." Ouch.
Right. Yeah, it is ouch, right? So that FIRE movement, that financial independence, retire early movement, really has kind of gained traction, particularly in the last year, but certainly over the last, 5 to 10 years, where individuals are realizing that they don't necessarily have to work for the entirety of their adult lives, that instead they can create a work for another organization and sort of be beholden to what others are kind of having them do. Instead, they're able to retire very early within their careers by being extreme in some cases. So some people would call that extreme in terms of their savings early on. And they're able to generate streams of revenue that are not your 9-to-5, you know, cubicle type work. And so they definitely have a culture, if you will, around them, Mr. Money Mustache being one of, I think, one of the first. But yeah, that quote is definitely hits home for me even. You know, I look at what we do and think, okay, wait, there's all this stuff. What is this stuff doing? He has some very colorful examples of that on his blog.
So is it possible to do that? And I would like to really question some of his choices. For example, I don't have any problem with his choices. I just wonder, is it possible to do that with any college debt? How does college debt play into this? And Sarah, I'd love to get your thoughts on college debt and where you're going to send your kids to school in terms of college debt. And then kids, you know, I ask myself, why aren't I wealthier? And then I go and I read, you know, the things you publish and things that a lot of other smart people publish. And it says, you know, raising a kid is $250,000 to $300,000. And I go, right, well, I got four of those things. You know, so there's $1.5 million out the door right there already, you know?
Yeah, so that's a great point. I think that in terms of college education and debt, I don't know where exactly you want to go with this one, but, you know, we talk about the fact that traditional four-year education, you know, I've got to do, my parents went to college this way, I'm going to go to college this way. I think that individuals that are going to be successful long-term, that are going to be the millionaires next door, are going to look at the state of education today, look at this sort of assumption that we're going to take on this debt to go to school and say, there's got to be another way. There's got to be a different way to approach education. And just like before, millionaires next door are going to look at things and do things a little differently. I think in terms of that FIRE community, if you look at sort of their focus, it's on that early savings and on that early repayment of any debt that's going on. So in terms of, you know, whether or not you can do that and have medical college debt, for example, I don't know the answer to that necessarily, but there are some members of the FIRE community that are doctors, several of them out there.
Have they ever been on a date, though, Sarah? You know, I mean, have they seen a movie in the last 20 years? You know, because at some point, you know, life is not worth saving if you're saving too much. You save the fun right out of it, you know? I got to have a little fun.
Yeah, I can't speak to everybody's experience, but I think that what most would share with you is they make sure that they're not wasting their money on things, again, that aren't giving them the experience or the lifestyle or the family experiences that they want in order to make that goal of being financially independent happen. So I think many of them, again, I'm not one of them, but I think that they would argue that they are fulfilling their goals while at the same time not, again, behaving or sort of acquiescing to what's going on around them in terms of how people spend and live their lives. So, but agreed, it's probably pretty challenging.
All right. I think the most startling research from the entire, or the most startling point, single point from the entire body of research has to do with inherited wealth, right? We all know that 95% of the rich people were inherited wealth, that the only way, the real American way to get wealthy is to inherit it or to divorce it, Sarah. We have to add that category, right? You know, the Tiger Woods, you know, success story. So I would say, I'm going to argue 96% of the millionaires in the United States inherited their wealth. What are your thoughts on this? I'm setting you up. There's a softball right down the plate, Sarah.
Yeah, so, you know, that's absolutely not what's been found over the last two-plus decades of research. In fact, it's quite the opposite, that, you know, 80% to 86% of millionaires have made it on their own. In our latest study, about 14% of millionaires receive any kind of income, for example, from a trust. They're not, you know, they're doing this on their own. And I think that that's what kind of propelled me to keep going with this research, to finish what my father started, is that, you know, this is something that you can do. It's just, you know, it takes hard work and it takes research and takes some focus.
Do you know how motivating that is to hear that 86%, and I tell this all the time, 86% of the millionaires are first generation millionaires. Is that a fair way to say the same data point, Sarah?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that
that's so motivating.
Absolutely. Yep.
That means it's up to you if you want to be successful. If you want to be a millionaire, it's up to you. I mean, that's what the data means to me. So,
definitely.
That's just so cool. And it's a great place for us to wrap it up. Dr. Falah, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on another incredible book. I think this stuff is so important. I'm so appreciative that you shared it with us. How would you like our readers to get a copy, find out more, follow you online, all that stuff, please?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Falah, all one word. And you can learn more about our research. We continue to do research in this field if you go to datapoints.com.
Fantastic. Sarah, thank you so much and have a great day.
Thank you for having me.
We're out of time, but back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone, and go make $1 million. Bye now.